The following program, USUN Report, is now available on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. Welcome to USUN Report with anchorman Tom Osborne, political historian Dr. David Canervo, and myself, Ken McCaleb, your weekly moderator. Together, we represent today's political spectrum, and it's nice to know that each week we can offer you differing points of view, and this week we're talking about another space race. We've titled this show, To Mars or Bust. Let's begin with a little explanation and commentary by our resident political scientist, Dr. David Canervo. David?
Thank you, Ken. The planet Mars has been of interest to human beings for really quite some time. Early scientists noticed the red hue of the planet and, of course, its proximity to Earth, and speculated that perhaps there was life forms of some sort on the planet. Popular culture picked up that idea, and over 100 years ago, H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds back in 1898, and Orson Welles adapted that to a radio play in 1938 and frightened a large number of Americans with it. A person from my hometown, Ray Bradbury, wrote The Martian Chronicles in 1950, and those who are Star Trek fans probably remember references made to Mars in that TV series. And so there's been an interest in Mars for quite some time, and generally the interest seems to either involve colonizing Mars or somehow trying to repel Martian invaders. NASA has been interested in Mars since the early 1960s. NASA has planned a trip to Mars with humans in the 2030s, and their plans tend to mirror what NASA did in seeking to land on the moon. Those of you who were interested in the moon landing were certainly aware of the three stages that NASA crew used. We had the single-person Mercury capsules, the two-person Gemini capsules, all of which orbited the Earth, and then the three-person Apollo capsule, which had the moon lander on it, and which was sent out to orbit the moon and then land from that orbit. The plan to go to Mars has a similar strategy to it. There are three stages. First is what's called Earth-reliant, where research is conducted aboard the International Space Station, and people are trained for long-term space environments and space habitation. The second period, or stage, is the proving ground, which is supposed to last until 2030. What this does is involve regular crewed missions and spacewalks in what is called cislunar space. Cislunar meaning within the orbit of the moon or close to the moon. So NASA will use its new powerful rocket called the Space Launch System, carry an unmanned Orion spacecraft to the moon and beyond on a three-week journey. It will return, and then, assuming that is successful, the astronauts will then fly a similar mission. If that works, then a year-long mission by astronauts will go into space beyond the moon, partially to Mars, and then come back. Because it takes 8 months to get to Mars, of course, a year-long mission means that it will go beyond the moon, but only part of the way toward Mars. There's also an interesting plan in which there will be an asteroid redirect mission to capture an asteroid, take samples of it, and then bring those samples back to Earth to test. And part of this mission is to test the idea of astronauts going into deep space and walking out in space. Finally, the test of a solar electric propulsion system will occur. And that's important because that propulsion system is going to be necessary for sending cargo to Mars. Now, the third stage of this process of traveling to Mars will be to build on these first two stages and place humans in low orbit around Mars, much as we did around the moon with Apollo. And this will test then the ability of the Orion spacecraft to enter into Mars's atmosphere, to descend to Mars, and various landing techniques which might be needed for getting onto the Martian surface. Astronauts would study the different exploration zones which have been identified on the planet Mars to see what is needed to live off the land. All this is following, of course, a whole series of robotic missions which have already occurred. One of the interesting things about what NASA has done is that since 1964 and up to 2013, there have been 19 observational and robotic missions, 14 of which have been successful. So, in fact, we've been sending technology to Mars for 54 years. So, this is an exciting adventure which NASA is planning, and let me turn it over to our anchorman, Tom Osborne. Tom?
Thank you very much, Dave. And for painting a picture of how we're going to get to Mars, it's very challenging, very interesting. I think President Kennedy would be very pleased with the debate. After all, he did say that we would put a man on the moon in the decade, and we did just that. Now we're debating about which one we should go colonize, the moon or Mars. So this is the perfect opportunity for me, I think, to revive that debate. If humans needed to beat a retreat from planet Earth, would it be better to live on Mars or the moon? That's the big question. And these days, a lot of us might be asking it. We know Elon Musk wants humans to live on Mars, and his spectacular achievement, not just weeks ago, bringing a rocket up and bringing it down to land, is a major step in that direction. NASA wants, at the very least, to send some astronauts over to the red planet, as David has suggested, probably more so around the planet than on it. Mars spins at a pretty reasonable rate. Its day is just over 24 hours long, so a day on Mars would be roughly equivalent to a day on Earth. However, a day on the moon lasts as long as 28 Earth days, which would take a fair bit of adjustment for any crew. The Trump administration has recently signaled that it's more interested in sending astronauts back to the moon. So that seems to be where NASA's pointing its arrow. On the moon, however, the day is also very hot. The night is very cold. There's almost 572 degrees Fahrenheit temperature difference between the day and night temperatures on the moon. And the large day-to-night temperature differences can make it really difficult to engineer the right living systems, such as habitats and cars for moving around and spacesuits for going outside. I should say that Mars has an atmosphere. It's not really a great atmosphere, but at least it is one, mostly carbon dioxide, which is great for plants, but it really sucks for humans. So we've got a problem there. The atmosphere, though, allows wind to blow, which helps to equalize the day-to-night temperature differences and causes a lot of dust to move around, too. Remember the last moon landing and the dust that the astronauts experienced and the powder that they walked in is not so much dust. It's very interesting. It has very jagged edges on it, and it's quite dangerous to the suits of the spacesuits because it cuts through the gloves. Something that's not the same as on Mars. At sea level, we breathe an atmosphere which is cubic meters, contains about 10, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 0 plus molecules. Now, the comparison in the lunar atmosphere has less than a million molecules in the same volume. So since the moon has so little atmosphere, any wind can really move heat from hot day side to the cold night side. The day is relatively short, and then the day-to-night temperature differences are not too dramatic. I'll say some more about the atmosphere of Mars, but I just wanted to give a taste of what it might be to go to either planet.
Well, you're listening to U.S. UN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. Canervo, and myself, Ken McCaleb. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to U.S. UN Report. I'm David Canervo, along with Ken McCaleb and Tom Osborne, and we're talking about traveling to Mars. Ken?
David, in our first segment, you spoke a lot about NASA, but NASA's not the only game in town anymore in the space program, and there are a couple of heroes that are emerging. I mean, we sort of skimmed by them, but let's talk about Sir Richard Branson and Elon Musk a little bit more. David, what do you know about Sir Richard Branson?
Well, I know that Branson is interested in space travel. He has put a lot of money into his company, which is promising to provide flights into the edge of space for private citizens at a pretty high price, I might say. But nevertheless, private citizens, the edge of space, and he hopes to begin that before too long. Though I know they did have an accident with their space plane a couple of years ago, but I think that they have since gotten back on track. Ken?
Yeah, you're right. He had an explosion on a plastic-based fuel that had yet to be ignited in flight. But that particular craft, the pilot and everyone were destroyed. But Sir Richard Branson is also interested in sort of rekindling the Concorde supersonic flights. And I think it's mostly for businesses. Tom Osborne, is there a real business or a real industry in that area?
Well, I think really, Ken, the whole project has now begun to move very deliberately toward capitalistic ideas and inventions and innovations. And it seems to me that's a great move because the government is so slow in allocating funds for projects like this, and they're so unbelievably huge budgets that they require a lot of support in the Congress where we're just not spending. So it's absolutely wonderful that Elon Musk and Sir Branson have taken on the initiative. So I think it's very exciting, and I suspect that's the way it's going to go because they do have the money to throw around. Ken?
Well, Sir Branson actually started a company called the Spaceship Company. It sounds almost cartoonish, but it was founded with along with Gabe Casanova through Virgin Group, which owns 70%, and the Lee family from Hong Kong, which owns another 30%, to build commercial spaceships and to launch aircraft for space travel. And from the time of TSC's formation in 2005, the launch customer was Virgin Galactic. And they contracted to build 5 Spaceship Twos and 2 White Knight Twos. And basically what this is do you remember, Dr. Canerva, when the space shuttle would transport itself on the piggyback on the top of an aircraft?
Yes, absolutely. That was quite a sight.
And what this spaceship company is doing is they're piggybacking on a mothership, the White Knight, I should say a fathership at this point, and they bring that up into the sky and launch it from the air, and then they glide down like the space shuttle did. So this really is more, Tom, I think you're right. I think it's more of a commercial venture and one that is evolving into something he's calling Virgin Orbit. And that started back in 2015. They've been pursuing a smaller launch vehicle. And they wanted to make it, they're calling it the small sat launch business. And it's becoming a larger part of his business plan. But now you guys talked a little bit about Elon Musk. He's going in a completely different direction. And I do remember seeing Richard Branson commenting right after the successful launch Elon had just 2-3 weeks ago. He says, I'm jealous. Does he have a right to be jealous, David?
Well, I think so. I think Musk has been quite successful with his SpaceX company, and the launches he's had the last few times have been quite spectacular and impressive. So I think there's a certain right to be jealous. Musk has done well for himself. He has been able to launch rockets and payloads into space to help supply the International Space home, which is up there. And so he's done quite well for himself. Needless to say, or not the least to say, he has his own car being advertised in space as it orbits the Earth. Ken?
Well, now, David, you know, after the VSS Enterprise, which was Branson's dream, there was an investment by a group out of Abu Dhabi, and they apparently have bought a huge stake in Virgin Galactic at a cost of $280 million, and they're receiving exclusive regional rights to launch tourism and scientific research space flights from the United Arab Emirates. Tom Osborne, these flights are going to cost in the neighborhood of $200,000 a seat. Do you think you'll see yourself getting on one of these?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I plan it on. Yeah, it's right on my bucket list. Maybe in a few years. We'll see how USUN report goes. I'd be delighted. Wouldn't that be fantastic? I mean, I think that's the whole excitement of this. The fact that we're even talking about going to Mars in my lifetime is a thrill. And I remember how thrilling the moonshot was. But, you know, I was starting to talk about the differences in the shots and what they require. But the question is whether we can survive there long enough to get a colony going. And it seems that Mars's atmosphere could stop a bunch of harmful EUV particles that would fry you, whereas you would have to probably live in caves on the moon, but on Mars it might be possible to live above the ground. You'd still get a fair bit of radiation exposure, though neither of them is great from a radiation standpoint if you wanted to choose. I think Mars sounds better. And in 1972, when there were a couple of moon landings, there were a lot of solar events, you may recall, at that time. And they were bad enough that they could have killed all of the astronauts on the moon if there'd been any there at the time. Mars, on the other hand, and of course everybody talks about this, and this is the most exciting aspect, I think, is that it has evidence of water. And it may exist in the subsurface all over Mars. Ready access to water would be so important, not only for our ability to stay hydrated and grow things, but it would also be used to create oxygen, more oxygen to breathe. And we'd probably have to live near the poles, scientists say, to access this water. The gravity on Mars is quite different. Also, it's more powerful than the gravity on the moon. If I were there, if I weighed 200 pounds, which I do not, it would be about 33 pounds. 75 pounds would be about the same on Mars. Increased gravity on Mars helps keep the atmosphere on the planet. And gravity can be useful for making objects stay put on the ground and keeping our bones a bit more robust. So it's better for our health also. More on the moon and the race on Mars. I'll turn it back to you, Ken.
Thank you, Tom. Elon Musk, who's an entrepreneur best known in space circles for his space exploration technology or SpaceX company, he became the first private company to ship cargo to the International Space Station back in 2012. He's been a long advocate for the Mars exploration, and Musk has publicly talked about ventures such as building a greenhouse on the red planet and more ambitiously establishing a Mars colony. He's also rethinking transportation concepts through ideas such as the Hyperloop, a proposed high-speed system that would run between major cities. This greenhouse attempt, David, do you know much about it?
I don't, though it sounds like a great idea to me. As Tom mentioned, oxygen is, of course, a concern. What I do remember from biology class is that green plants will, through the process of photosynthesis, turn carbon dioxide into water and oxygen. And so that sounds like a very necessary and useful project. Ken?
Well, you're listening to USUN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Canervo, and myself, Ken McCaleb. We're up against a hard break, but if you'll stay with us, we'll be back right after these messages.
Welcome back to U.S. UN Report. I'm Tom Osborne with Ken McCaleb and Dr. David Canervo. We've been talking about going to Mars, Mars or bust. But the debate is also about the moon, which is the best way to go. Seems like we're going to have to go to the moon first. But one of the things that really fascinates me about the whole project, and I'm afraid I might not make it to 2030, but we'll take a shot at it. The moon is a big chunk of the Earth that split off a long time ago. We have to remember that. And so we can imagine what kind of archaeology we might be able to do on the moon. Mars, on the other hand, is a totally separate planet that evolved on its own. And we know that the moon is close to the Earth. It would save a lot of fuel money if we go there first. And we do have the rockets right now that can load a lot of stuff on the moon. And David mentioned this, and this is very important. The important point is that we are now going to the moon first, it seems, and we're going to put a lot of equipment, dumping supplies on the moon, so that we will have start sending water and rocket fuel for the journey home with other supplies to Mars. It's like almost like beginning the whole United States of America again. Colonizing another planet is just beyond belief. Some people theorize that there could actually be life there. Not like human life, but probably a tiny bacteria organism or something like that. But one of the main reasons that we keep going back there is that scientifically Mars is a much better destination than the moon. It's named after the Roman god of war, and it's also capitalized. I didn't know that. Instead, the moon is not. And I don't know the answer to that. Ken?
Well, we were talking about Elon Musk just a little while ago, and I wanted to reiterate that Musk funded SpaceX through his own money at first, and then he gained enough experience to attract millions of dollars for NASA to develop his rockets and spacecraft to bring the cargo to the International Space Station. He's also received launch contracts from entities such as the U.S. Air Force. You know, Mr. Musk is obviously a very successful entrepreneur to the point that NASA and everybody wants to collaborate with him. But he's not the only guy in town. Apparently, now, gentlemen, are you aware that Mr. Musk has some competition in a gentleman by the name of Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon? David, you know anything about this?
I don't. I know of Jeff Bezos, but I don't know about his interest in space travel.
Well, he has his own rocket company. In fact, it's called Blue Origin, which this month announced a new rocket. He's calling it the New Glenn. I guess that's after John Glenn. I don't know. And it approaches the Saturn V in stature, but it's dwarfed by SpaceX's newest rocket. So, at a talk recently, Robert Meyerson, Blue Origin's president, said the aim of the New Glenn was to take people to space, although it will also be able to launch satellites. The images the company released show the satellite-carrying version. But Mr. Meyerson disclosed that there are versions that will have a space vehicle on top. Mr. Bezos, of course, Amazon's wealthiest entrepreneur, Blue Origin's faced less pressure to be profitable as quickly as SpaceX or public companies like Boeing or Lockheed Martin, because they have to answer to shareholders. So this is quietly working under the radar, but there you go. We do have a space race, don't we, Tom Osborne?
We certainly do, and I think it's going to be very exciting to see how it develops and how we move closer to our next moonshot in order to prepare for it. It's interesting that when we go to Mars, we require such a huge rocket to get even a small amount of stuff on the surface. The rockets that we took to the moon and back were the largest rockets that we have ever built. So we haven't invented that yet. There's a lot of things that we have yet to invent for the trip to the moon that we'll build on our trip to Mars. Our moon trip, it was only large enough to hold the tiniest of crews, guys crammed into a tiny space about the size of a minivan. That's fine for a three-day journey to the moon, but it really wouldn't work for the six-month journey to Mars. So we have to build a rocket that can go to Mars and back again. And at this point, those don't exist yet, Ken.
Well, part of Elon's vision, he says, he wants each of his SpaceX vehicles will carry 100 passengers on the journey to Mars, with trips planned every 26 months when Earth and Mars pass close to each other. He also said that the first flights would be fairly expensive, but ticket prices might eventually fall to between $100,000 and $200,000 a person. That seems to be a magic number between Richard Branson and Elon Musk. Now, to establish a self-sustaining Mars civilization of a million people would take 10,000 flights, with many more to ferry equipment and supplies. He says, we're going to need something quite large to do that. It'll take 40 years to a century before the city on Mars becomes self-sufficient. The mood at a recent press conference was almost giddy as a rock concert in the launch of the new Apple product, while people lining up for Mr. Musk's presentation a couple of hours in advance. They all wanted to see him. He's become somewhat of a cult hero, hasn't he, Tom Osborne?
Yes, he certainly has. And it's the kind of hero we need right now, I think, in the United States and really in the world now. This man is both of these men are really citizens of the world. And they look at their fortunes in a way that most people don't. They see that they have an obligation to contribute to the future of our planet and to take new space exploration to its furthest point, so that we can have the answers to the questions that we have now that still don't give us those new rockets and the rockets that are big enough to take us there. It's interesting, though, but if you're going to, as you pointed out, the Martian year is much longer than an Earth year, and there is that problem of aligning in the way for travel. And so how long are these the people that can fund these projects going to be around? I suppose they'll establish foundations, and that those would be drawn upon for future efforts. But I'm certainly glad that there are individuals taking the risk in our time, they're history makers, and we wish them well. Ken?
Well, as you both know, Mr. Musk's initial wealth came from the creation of PayPal. He was the executive of PayPal. And he sold that to eBay back in 2002 for $1.5 billion. He wanted to undertake scientific experiments, and that's where the greenhouse idea came. I think he's sort of abandoned that for now. He also comments that NASA is still talking about its Mars ambitions. I think they might actually be trying to collaborate a lot more these days with its own giant rocket. But he admits that the NASA plans astronauts setting foot on Mars might take longer, so he doesn't want to wait around. He thinks they'll get there in 2040, even though they're announcing 2030, but he wants to get there sooner. And Mr. Musk is confident that his company can pull this off. But he said he would not be among the first colonists, saying he wants to see his children grow up. So he's not going to go himself, but he says the chances of dying on that first trip to Mars are quite high. Dr. Canervo, is he being a realist here?
Absolutely. There are all sorts of health problems that are going to face the early pioneers who go to Mars. Among them, such things as space sickness. Many of the astronauts face nausea as they travel. The mental stress of being in, as Tom pointed out, a fairly confined space for an 8-month trip. Plus the worry and concerns of other things going on, our muscles will weaken because of the lack of gravity. Eye problems develop, such things as specs develop in space travel that get into your eyes. Fluids in the eye, because of the lack of gravity, rise and cause problems. Potential for coughs and colds. And finally, such things as medical emergencies. What happens if during the space trip someone needs an appendectomy? So those are among the kinds of issues that are really problematic for those seeking to travel to Mars. Ken?
Well, you're listening to U.S. UN Report with Tom Osborne, Dr. David Canervo, and me, Ken McCaleb. And we're talking about To Mars or Bust. So stay with us. We'll be back right after these messages.
Welcome back to U.S. UN Report. I'm Tom Osborne with Ken McCaleb and Dr. David Canervo. Ken?
Well, in our space race, I want you to remember this following name because you might see it again. Aisha Mustafa, a 19-year-old Egyptian physics student, patented a new type of propulsion system for spacecraft that uses cutting-edge quantum physics instead of thrusters. First, a little background. One of the strange quantum facts at work in Mustafa's engined idea is that there's no such thing as a vacuum, devoid of particles, waves, and energy. Instead, the universe's supposedly empty spaces are filled with a roiling sea of particles and antiparticles that pop into existence, then annihilate each other in such a short space of time that you can't readily detect them. So Mustafa invented a way of tapping this quantum effect via what's known as the dynamic Casimir effect. This uses a moving mirror cavity where two very reflective flat pieces or plates are held close together and then move slightly to interact with the quantum particle C. It's horribly technical, but the end result is that Mustafa's use of shaped silicone plates similar to those used in solar power cells results in a net force being delivered. A force, of course, means a push or a pull, and in space, this equates to a drive or an engine. Dr. Canerva, are you aware of this Egyptian student?
No, I'm not, but certainly her idea is very exciting, and I hope that she is successful in developing this technology. This is certainly out-of-the-box thinking and something which we will need for future space travel. Ken?
Tom, whenever you entered the United Nations building, did you ever see the Sputnik and the information desk? There was a copy of it up above?
I did see that, Ken, and I was very amazed. It was quite amazing to think that that was sent to outer space, and we have it in a procession. What I suppose it went into storage or for safekeeping or back to where it came from. Don't know where it went.
Well, actually, it's just a model, but it was a full-scale model. Now, are you also aware, gentlemen, that the UN has its own outer space division? David, did you know that?
I did not know that, but it sounds interesting. It reminds me of the Men in Black.
Well, when aliens finally land on Earth and they utter those five fateful words, "Take me to your leader," the United Nations will know just who to call. Or so they say. I'm not so sure about this story, but I have heard it for a number of years, and as a staff member at the UN, we used to kid about it a lot. But according to some British news reports, the UN is set to appoint a Malaysian astrophysicist, Mazian Othman, as the world's organization's space ambassador for extraterrestrial contact affairs. This would make him the first point of contact if aliens ever reached out to us. But it seems there may be some confusion as to whether these reports are real. Tom Osborne?
Well, whether or not life actually existed there or still does will be hard to answer. The NASA chief scientist for many years have been saying that the question would best be solved by astronauts, geologists, that is. I think that it's going to take astrobiologists or geologists and chemists on the surface of Mars to be able to go out and read the landscape, pick up the rocks, and take them into a lab and really resolve the question of whether life really arose on Mars. We'll have to wait for that answer till we get there.
The Office of Outer Space Affairs was established in 1962, and it's based at the United Nations office in Vienna, Austria. Now, Stephen Hawkins, the British scientist, stated that if intelligent alien life form does exist out in the vastness of space, they might not be that friendly cosmic neighbor that we've been looking for. David, your final thoughts?
It does make sense to me that the extraterrestrial life that we find may not be like E.T., but may in fact be people who really don't want to deal with us and may in fact see us as quite inferior because their technology most likely would be far superior to ours. Ken?
Well, as always, we've run out of time. Tom Osborne, you have the final say.
Well, thank you, Ken and David. I hope that all of us will keep our eyes on the stars, as the saying goes, and our feet on the ground, and that you all join us next week for USUN Report.